Tonight it's my great pleasure to welcome for the first time to Many Rivers Books and Tea, as in her speaking capacity, Judith Goleman, MFT, a rabbinic pastor in the Jewish Renewal Movement. She has been a marriage and family therapist for 36 years in Sebastopol, which is longer than I've been in Sonoma County by a year. That seems like a long time to me. She was ordained last year as a rabbinic pastor in the Jewish Renewal Movement and has been in love with the concepts of Jewish mysticism throughout her life. And tonight she'll be speaking to us about living as a couple, as a spiritual practice, through the lens, I guess, or with the assistance of the Jewish mystical tradition. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay, that's all. No. Yeah, so first I want to talk about the Jewish mystical tradition, because Jewish people in America don't really know this tradition, and non-Jewish people don't really know this tradition. And it's beautiful. It's incredible. It's grounded. It's joyful. And it fits my experience of how things are. So, and I actually fell in love with it when I was 15, and I read Martin Buber's Tales of the Hasidim, which they happen to have on this table, to get an insight into this view of life. So, and the reason that that tradition isn't known is that it was kind of held as a secret in the old country, in the little villages. And if you were of good character and married and, you know, had a job and were living a very ethical life and had spiritual gifts, you would be taken aside and taught that it's called the Kabbalah. You would be taught about it. Everyone else wouldn't know about it. And then, you know, America was discovered and the young people went to America and wanted to be Americans. And Judaism started to try to be American. And I grew up in what they call classic reform, which dropped everything that didn't make rational sense and we thought would make us not look American. So most of the beautiful, deep, mystical practices fell away from that form of Judaism. And the line that held the mysticism became, to my view, a little rigid. There are Hasidim, you see them dressed in Polish costumes of the 18th century. And they're living a life of, but they, you know, a defined life of following mitzvot and having a sense of holiness that comes from that. And then they hold these mystical teachings also, but they aren't very accessible until the 60s, 70s, when people like Arya Kaplan, who's written several of these books, started bringing the concepts out into the mainstream. So if you wanted to, you could buy a book tonight, I guarantee you won't understand it, called Sefer Yetzirah. It was like a very secret, little known, mystical text, and very difficult to understand, that now is, you know, through Shambhala Press, you can have your own copy. And I would say the mystical teachings, they are in Judaism. They're there. I mean, I'll be describing them to you, and they make you feel that holiness is your nature, you know, a holiness in the sense of joy and truth, that is in fact your nature. And there's a prayer Jews say every morning and night traditionally that ends, you know, to be holy unto your God. Like, it's natural, you can do it. And also the teaching that the whole point of being alive as a human is to try to fix a world that has been broken, and that when it's fixed, it does express its real nature. And so Jews, even who think they aren't Jewish, will be socially active, trying to feed the hungry and bring justice and so on and so on. So these teachings permeate normative Judaism, even though they haven't really been studied and known in their direct form that much in America. Okay, so when I speak tonight about why being a couple is a spiritual practice, why the difficult challenges of being a couple are a spiritual practice, I'm going to do it in the context of these Jewish mystical teachings, which I'll now teach you. So I want to talk about the Kabbalistic creation story. So in the Bible, in the Torah, there's a creation story, right? God, what happens? God makes the world happen, right? And what the Kabbalah does is it takes the first phrase, right? It says, Bereshit bara Elohim et Adonai. It means, in the beginning of things, God created the world. And the word et just means a direct object is coming, right? It's a Hebrew word that means, look out, there's a direct object coming. But it's made of the first letter of the alphabet and the last letter of the alphabet. And so in the mystical tradition, the letters have a great deal, a tremendous deep holiness. Like each letter is thought to have qualities, sort of like a atom. And so they say that God created the world out of these letters. And then a great tradition grew up around the essence of each letter. But I'm not going to talk about that, partly because I don't know it deeply. But so in the Kabbalistic creation story, God, first of all, everything was perfect, just perfection. Perfect wisdom, perfect beauty, perfect everything. And God felt a longing to create this world and us. And God longed to create a being, as you, who could be put into a broken world and not told that there was any point in fixing it, and would, out of absolute free choice, start fixing it. Okay, so this is the story. That God took God's energy and created a space for this world, because everything was perfect, it was full of perfection. So he created a space for this world. And then he created 10 qualities, and the qualities are the crown, which is still part of divinity, and then two qualities very resonant with divinity, that's chokhmah and bina, wisdom, and then taking that and trying to understand it and use it. And those are kind of, you may not be in touch with those, they're available, but they're kind of on a higher level of resonance, you could say. Then they're the qualities that are right here in our world, and those are loving kindness in a balance with limits, boundaries, strength, or let's say in a pair, they're not always in a balance, but hopefully they could be in a balance. I hope that's making sense. So on one side you have loving kindness, on the other side you have limits, boundaries, and strength. And if you get them into the right balance with each other, if you have too much loving kindness, you're kind of mush, right? If you have too much limits, balance, and strength, you can be cruel. But if you get them just into the right balance, you get to the middle one, which is beauty. On the next level down, there's endurance in balance with sensitive receptivity. And then the middle one, and the quality, on that level is connection. And then the bottom quality that receives everything is called thought of as feminine, and it's pure receptivity. So those are the containers, you could say. So God is pouring God's energy into these containers, and the story goes that the loving kindness wanted to keep all the loving kindness, and the limits wanted to keep all the limits. And just as God intended, these original containers broke. They couldn't contain the energy of the holiness, because in order to contain it, they had to be freely sharing it among each other. So that gives us the world we have, which is God's divine light essence of beauty and joy, and broken pieces of containers. Right? And so our job is to restore the containers to their wholeness and keep the flow going in the right way so that we restore the nature of the world. Another way this is put, which is by Martin Buber, is that what we have are, you could say, sparks of holiness that are the real nature of everything, that are contained inside shells or trapped inside shells. and the job is to open the shell and let out the spark of holiness. So when you drink a glass of water, let's say if you greet the water in its essential nature, you can set free its sparks of holiness. Right? Or if you just say, oh, water, you know, or what did Reagan say, you've seen one tree, you've seen them all, you don't set the sparks free. So in this view, the reason humans were created is one to fix the world, right? And the other reason is to enjoy the beauty of the world. And there's a Jewish saying that when you die and you go to the heavenly court or whatever, that you're held accountable for joys of this world that you could have enjoyed with no harm to anyone, such as this beautiful necklace she's wearing, that you neglected to enjoy. Because God wants this creation to be appreciated and received. So that's Kabbalistic view. And so in that view, we have this task, which is to try to fix everything that's out of kilter that we can, or that we have access to in this creation. Well, one of the things we have access to is ourselves, right? So, ourselves. Yeah. And I remember there was some well-known psychologist about 15 years ago who was talking about the inner child, and he said that 5% of families are healthy, wholesome families. 5%. Right? So let's just say most of us, except for your family, you're obviously one of them. And so most of us get some hurt as we grow up in our families, and we, you could say, get out of balance in one way or another. And then we get married and we are out of balance one way or another, and our partner starts saying, oh, I can't believe you're doing this again. You know? And so one reason living as a couple is a spiritual practice is that if we want to fix something, we have to know where it's broken. And who knows better than our partner that lives with us every day where we are somewhat, if we are, where we're out of balance. And your friends can know this also. So, there's another concept. This isn't exactly from Kabbalah that I want to give you, that I work with when I think of working with couples as a spiritual practice. And that is, there are quite a few names for God in Judaism. They're kind of like love names of various kinds. But there's one that we never say aloud. In fact, we don't know any. It was only said once a year by the high priest in the Holy of Holies, when we had the temple 2,000 years ago. But it's called the Tetragrammaton. It's made of four letters. And when we see these four letters, which they're in many, many prayers, there's another word we say instead. It's so sacred, we never say it aloud. But it's made up of several forms of the verb to be kind of crunched together. So my rabbi, Michael Robinson, told me that the meaning of this name of God is the unfolding of reality itself. So that's another way of saying that reality itself is where holiness is, right? That's where holiness is. So these things that happen to us in our family, to my view, prevent us from seeing some little piece of reality the way it is. So you could say they're between us and God, if you like to speak that way, which I do like to. It's usually mine. I remember to hear mine. So now I want to talk about brain science, because it's part of reality itself. So one of the main things that causes trouble between people has to do with a part of the brain called the amygdala. And the amygdala isn't your thinking brain, right? And the amygdala isn't fight or flight reptilian brain. It's a part of your brain that just wants you to be safe. And it's a part of your brain that has experienced all your experiences. And the problem with the amygdala is it has no sense of time. And another problem with the amygdala is it can take over your thinking brain very fast. There's one neuron. So if something is a little bit like a very unpleasant early experience, the amygdala thinks it is that experience. And so you react with all the energy and force that was called for by the early experience. But it's not a good fit, generally, with the reality of the present. For example, let's say you had a father, you grew up with a father who was scary, alcoholic, full of rage, unpredictable, scary, right? Loud rages. So then you go through your life and you get married, and your partner, who happens to be a very balanced, lovely, rational person who doesn't drink or etc., gets mad and raises his voice a little bit. And your amygdala thinks, uh-oh, here comes out of control, violent rage. I better do something. And so you insult him, or you stalk out of the room, or you do something that doesn't fit the actual reality of who he is, but does fit the early reality very, very precisely. So a lot of healing has to do with facing, you know, the nice thing is this will make him uncomfortable, right, or her, you know, make the other person uncomfortable. And then if you read the right books, or you come to see me or something, that you can see how appropriate it is for your amygdala to think this, given your early experience, and how bad a fit it is, you know, with the present. And then it takes quite a bit of work to convince the amygdala that you are as safe as you are. The amygdala, it's like Missouri showed me, you know. What you have to do is you have to build new neural pathways. Do you have a question? Yes.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking that amygdala sounds like it should be the name of a Hebrew letter. But I was thinking right away of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Oh, yeah.
And I was and wondering about the relationship between, I mean, it's almost like they're the same thing.
Oh, yeah.
So it's how does the amygdala resolve that the amygdala in a healthy life?
Right.
I mean, because it's going to do its thing.
Oh, yeah. Right. No, how do you heal it? Right? And you're right, post-traumatic stress is another example, you know, where you've had experiences that are overwhelming, and then the amygdala is constantly saying, oh, maybe this is like that. Maybe this is, like, you know, where you're in a state of that's appropriate to what you went through, but isn't appropriate to, say, Sebastopol downtown on a Thursday evening. Okay, so how do you heal the amygdala? You heal it through reality itself. The reality. And it takes work, you know, but what you want to do is do everything you can to let in the safety of the present. And you want to build new neural pathways, and you want to build a lot of them. You want to build a lot of them, like, oh, I'm safe, no bombs here. You know, look at how sweet it is here. Look how, what sweet people. And you try to let that in as deeply as you can. Deeply as you can. And so finally, you've done it enough times that the amygdala says, oh yeah, you're right, this is downtown Sebastopol.
This is
downtown Sebastopol. Yeah. And in a couple's relationship, couples actually can become a healing, you know, actively healing for each other. Like if you know your partner grew up in scary rage families, you can make sure that when you are angry that you say, you know, I'm angry, but I you're really safe with me. I love you. You know, we're safe. I need to tell you that you once again didn't buy the kind of toothpaste I like. You know, But you can start building, you can start actively healing whatever the early trauma was by clearly being. Now the problem is that when we've been traumatized, for some reason, we tend to recreate the situation. It's so interesting. I've seen innocent bystanders pulled into acting like schmoes somehow, you know, because that's what the person believes they are. How does this work? My brain is in. It's fascinating. But if instead you decide you're going to go for healing and you. Let me just sit with what I'm going to say. Yeah, well, you just actively provide the missing experience. Let's say your partner grew up in a very cold kind of emotional environment. You can make sure that your partner feels your warmth. And the partner may resist your warmth, not familiar. Yeah. So it takes work to change these things, to open, to let in what you need. So another way that living as a couple can be a spiritual practice of trying to get more in touch with reality is how you communicate with each other. How you communicate with each other. So one of the common problems in communication is that when any of us feel vulnerable, it's tempting to act angry instead of vulnerable. Because angry feels stronger. I mean, none of you people that meditate a lot do this, right? But the truth is that going with whatever's the deepest thing in your heart, saying it, will open your partner's heart up. Whereas if you go somewhere to anything else, it will just be confusing. Okay, so what are some examples of this? Well, they talk about I messages, where you report on your own insides, as opposed to you messages, where you tell your partner what a schmo they are. So, like, for example, I came up with some examples of this. I mean, we all know them, but okay. Let's say your partner works a lot in the evening. And you could say, "You're just so insensitive. You're never here when I need you. You know, you're just a workaholic." Like that. Those are you messages. Okay. An I message might be something like, "You know, when you work so much, I start being afraid you don't really like being with me, and I feel frightened and I get lonely for you." Right. That's an I message. And it's a report on your reality. And it makes more reality between you. I want to give an example of a fake I message. When you work so much, I feel that you're a selfish, inconsiderate workaholic. That's not an I message. So, so that working on one's communication skills is a way of honoring the divine. Right, because you're acknowledging what's real for you, you're allowing that to be seen by your partner, and you're working on seeing your partner for who they are. And that's a spiritual practice. I can't think of anything else to tell you. What else? Do you have any questions?
I was wondering about the word fix. You spoke about fixing, you know, that mm-hmm. that's seeing the beauty in the world and repairing in some way the world, fixing it, that could get to be kind of meddlesome in some way. I mean, having that view, I can imagine.
You've met Jewish people, right?
That's why I'm saying it.
But I want to speak to that more seriously.
Yeah.
I think one way that I feel, you know, I use the word God, right? And the word has been very misused, I think. So that, you know, we can hardly relate to it. But I think there's a way that you can feel that the universe cares what you do. That's what the way I feel. Like, for example, if you see a child being hurt, beaten, let's say, you know that's not right. You know that's not right. Or, you know, that if you yourself tell some lies for your own advantage, you know that isn't, that's not the way it should be. I mean, there are people that think it is the way it should be, but that's their problem. You know, hopefully, just over a few lifetimes, because Jewish mysticism believes in reincarnation, they'll learn otherwise. Now, you're right that if I think I know where you need fixing, I could become very meddlesome. That's my problem. I'm out of alignment with reality. I'm not respecting you. Okay, so there is certainly a way that feeling that you want to fix the world can become yucky. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about how when you do an unselfish good deed, just give someone a gift they need for no reason except to do it, you are fixing the world. You're fixing that little bit of reality. You're aligning it with the way it is meant to be in this concept of God. But when you tell your neighbor, oh, you're doing it, oh, I need to fix you, you're wrong, you're being a schmo, in my opinion.
Is there another way to say fix that comes a little bit, that bypasses all the knee-jerk reactions we have to that word?
You can say it in Hebrew, tikkun olam, healing of the universe. Maybe healing is better, bringing it to its wholeness.
This is like something like putting things in their correct alignment when the alignment is disturbed.
That's very nice.
Mm-hmm. And how do we as individuals know what the correct alignment is? Seems like there's a hazard there in passing judgment on what
oh,
is.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So one has to have a pretty secure place to stand when making that evaluation.
Right. I know, and we constantly have to be assessing ourselves. Am I doing this for my ego? You know,
mm-hmm.
Am I doing this for a sense of power over? It's like that's part of tikkun olam, is watching your own motivation and getting it as unselfish as possible.
And certainly we don't want to stop people from assisting the proper alignment of things just because their ego is invested.
No, in fact, you know, this talks about in Judaism that doing things that are good for the wrong reasons, go ahead and do them. Go ahead and do them. And then eventually you might do them for better reasons. And I think I forgot to tell you, first of all, Jewish mysticism believes in reincarnation, many lives. And every time you do that unselfish good deed that we're talking about, you're purifying some little part of your body, you say. It's getting fixed, getting aligned. And over many, many lifetimes, you're going to get completely aligned with divinity. Everybody. I'm not sure that's true. Sometimes they don't. Not everybody. By that. Yeah.
Alignment. It doesn't seem to be like a mode, something you deduce from analysis. Am I correct about that?
It isn't for me.
Is it? I'm trying to bridge from, you know, like my own tradition to what you're talking about. In the Quaker tradition, they talk about they sit in silence so that they can enter into the inner light. And from that experience of the inner light, then you know what to do in the world.
Right.
Is that?
It's very similar.
It is similar.
Very similar.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, there's this sense that all of us have inner light inside us. And I guess I didn't talk about the soul, the four worlds and the souls that we have in each world. But in the idea is that really your truest nature is light, of God. But that you may not be in touch with that. But you could get in touch with it. And every time you do these unselfish good deeds, you're getting a little more in touch with that. And there's this concept of that you have four souls. You actually have more than four, but there are four main souls. You have a body level soul. You have an emotional level soul. You have a soul that relates to your creative intellect. And you have a soul that's just combined with God. And you may or may not be in touch with these souls. But so the body level soul, I think with some dancers, you can see them express their body level soul, right? The emotional level soul, they speak of angels running or spirit beings running and returning. And I think, I've come to think that the angels that are running are when your emotions carry you away and you yell at your child, that you do things you don't really mean. You know, and the angels returning are those emotions that deeply express everything you feel. And then on the creative mind level, the soul knows that it's part of God. And then the next soul up is just joined with God. Why did I tell you this? You asked a question.
Light. About the inner light, because you were talking about healing the world, and people were talking, well, how do you know what to fix? And I was thinking that in the Quaker tradition, they say the experience of the inner light allows you to understand what to do,
Right. Okay, so in Judaism, there are two opposite approaches. There's that approach of you're growing more and more light in yourself, and you just know how what to do. The other is the 20 volumes of the Talmud.
They just finished the cycle of reading of that, didn't they?
The Talmud is like the whole point, in a way, is how to be a humane person, right? That's one of the whole points of Judaism, how to act in a humane way. So the Talmud takes all these examples. What if there's a valuable object on the ground and somebody on a horse sees it and somebody on the ground also picks it up? Whose is it, right? You know, they're trying to the Talmud is trying to figure out rationally how should you act to be a humane person. I'll give you a better example than that. So insects are regarded as not being kosher, most of them. Actually, there's some locusts that are kosher. If you want to eat certain locusts, you can do it. But what if you're wearing your prayer shawl and an insect lands on your prayer shawl? Do you have to do a ritual cleansing of your prayer shawl? Right? This is a Talmudic question. And the neat thing about the Talmud is there, all the opinions are left in. Right? It's not, oh, this is the right way, we've got it. It's more, so in this case, one rabbi says, well, if the insect just lands and flies away, you don't have to do a ritual cleansing of your prayer shawl. And then another rabbi says, well, yeah, but what if you smush the insect into your prayer shawl? Then you do a ritual cleansing of the prayer shawl. And then a third rabbi says, well, even if the insect just lands for a moment and flies away, if you're one of the builders and healers of the world, you still have to do a ritual cleansing of your prayer shawl because it will bother you. So that's an example of Talmudic thought and Talmudic arguing. So we approach it two opposite ways. One, you build your light and then you intuitively know. Secondly, you look in the Talmud and see, you know, what's the proper way to behave in this situation.
Thank you. So it sounds like it takes a lifetime of study, one way or the other, or both, to be in harmony enough with the universe or the system or whatever to actually know what decisions to make about how to align or heal things around you.
I'm sure it's an ongoing thing
all the time.
But don't you feel that you do know often? You know, like if you see someone being too harsh with their child, and you know it, right? You just know. So I think that, like, when I think of, I was brought up very Reform Jewish, not traditional, and then I fell in love with Judaism. But I don't feel drawn to fulfill all the commandments. Like, I don't really keep, I keep kosher light, you know. Like, I don't eat milk with meat, but I don't eat kosher meat because I, anyway, why am I saying this? I'm losing my train of thought. How do you know? So, but, and I feel that we know. And through inner light, you know. You do know, yeah.
So, is it the case that the challenge or the work is to remove the obstacles or the obscurations as opposed to creating something that's not there?
That's my whole lecture, as opposed to creating something that's not there. You're removing the things that obscure your vision internally or externally.
So intrinsically we have the awareness or we have the knowing of what is whole and complete.
That's right.
And can act accordingly, but there are obstacles or obscurations that cause confusion.
Right, like they were told, go ahead and cheat on your income tax, you know, or whatever it is. There's a lovely legend that kind of expresses this, and that is that before a baby is born, they know everything. They can see light from one end of the universe to the other, and they have complete beautiful understanding. Just before you're born, an angel makes sure you forget. So you're born and you have to figure it out, but every time you get it right, it's like a memory. It's not like, oh, I guess this is, it's like, oh, yeah. Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
No.
No?
No.
What? What do you mean no? What?
No. The problem is that we introduce material to children as though they don't already know.
Yeah.
And so that message is slowly becomes imprinted on their natural knowing until because knowing itself is so innocent that it doesn't know that it is. The child doesn't know that they already know. And so they start believing that. It's the same thing with divine presence, that we move into we're born into a reality that doesn't see that as being as the actuality, and so we move into a kind of a spell of absence instead of presence.
Very nice, thank you. I mean, to me, you've described one of the many ways we abuse our children, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like not respecting their inner light.
Mm-hmm.
And you've described the problem of growing up in America,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is probably one of the most materialistic cultures that exists. I mean, there are others that have existed, but we're way up there, I think, in terms of not seeing holiness everywhere. Not valuing our elders, not valuing our children, not valuing the earth, not value, you know. What do we value? The next iPod or something? I mean, how happy does that make you? Well, your grandma might be able to make you happier. But I won't have to spend another lecture. Yeah.
I missed what you said earlier, so I'm sorry, and maybe for repeating, but so when in terms of relationships and spiritual relationships, or handy relationships spiritually, suppose you you're in a relationship and you want okay, I'll give you an example. I have a friend who wants to find a partner who will only be a vegetarian. So not that she doesn't have that right to, but in terms of, say they were partnered and one wanted to eat meat and the other one didn't like that, the other person ate meat.
Right.
So what do you say to that kind of situation?
Well, it makes me think of something I've called in my counseling practice negotiable and non-negotiable needs. And many differences that come up between couples are negotiable. You know, like I happen to be with somebody who likes cold air blowing in through the window at night.
What is a non-negotiable
need? I'll give an example.
Okay.
I had a client who needed to have horses. The way you know it's non-negotiable is if you try to negotiate it, you're cutting into who you are. It just doesn't work. It didn't make any sense to her husband. It was expensive. It didn't make sense to her husband. But it was truly a non-negotiable need. She had to have horses. So when a need is a non-negotiable need, you either adjust or you break up or whatever you do. You know, the person would cut into the essence of who they are if they gave up whatever it is. So in this case, it's just,
well,
yeah.
Wouldn't you say, okay, so is that very spiritual to say this woman has a need for horses and her partner, why would he object to that? Or what grounds would he have to object to it that would be holy in the eyes of God?
What a question. Let me sit with that.
Must be a page in the Talmud.
Somewhere.
Chapters.
Okay, let me just sit with that. Okay, so he didn't object. He realized how badly she needed it, and he went along with it.
And he cared about her more than he cared about whatever the other reasons are. Okay.
Now, if he said, you know what, it's too expensive, I don't want us to do it, and he stuck to that, to my view, he would be out of alignment with his seeing of her and his respect for her, to my view.
Yeah, and his love and caring for her.
Exactly.
Unless he couldn't afford it or something.
Right,
or
right.
It was putting him in jeopardy.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess
it's very tricky.
You know,
it's very delicate.
When do you not give somebody what they want? When do you not give somebody what they want if it's someone you love? And
when you can't without harming your own integrity.
Or if it harms them.
Or it harms them, yeah.
No, you can't run out in the street when cars are coming because it will harm you. But ultimately, a spiritual position is a very giving, is a loving position and an unselfish position, I would think.
Well, I think the way I would say it is it's respectful. It really sees the other for who they are, and see yourself for who you are, and then you try to do the best you can do, to be helpful.
But then what's the difference between giving somebody something they want because you love them and being a doormat? Or when is there a...
Oh, you missed the balance of chesed and gevurah.
Oh, I did.
Yes. So this is the 10 qualities called the sefirot that are part of the Jewish mystical tradition, and there's a pair of that are in balance, hopefully, with each other, or you want them to be. One is loving kindness, in balance with limits, boundaries, and strength. As you said, if you're all loving kindness, you're a doormat. If you're all limits, boundaries, and strength, as I said earlier, you can be cruel. So you want to get those in the right balance with each other so you can have beauty in the middle. Mm-hmm. Easier said than that. Mm-hmm. Yes.
In my experience, some of what you're talking about requires a discipline of self-awareness. And so I'm interested in your practice, or perhaps in your rabbinical teaching now. Is there a practice that you recommend to people that gives them a foundation on which to see each other in the clarity that you're describing?
I would send them to some of these Buddhist teachers that are out there. Because I think the intention to develop it helps develop it. Running into problems because you're not being aware helps. And, you know, looking for somebody like me that will just put you under the magnifying glass and see what's going on that's making trouble and see where the movement is that can make happiness can help.
Okay, but I guess partly I'm wondering within the context of Jewish mysticism,
right.
Is there a formalized practice along those lines that is maybe analogous to what you might send someone to the Buddhists to engage
right.
in?
Well, in Jewish practice, you end up doing prayers 3 times a day, right? And in the prayers you're asking to try to be holy and to, you know, love God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. And then there's a lot, there are a lot of very beautiful writings that do help. But Judaism is kind of more live it out and do your best and, you know, try to develop your light. It's not as, I think Buddhism really is a better technical method, I mean technology for self-development. Because you can be Jewish, you can really not develop. You know, particularly, I mean, and hopefully you will, but I have to think about what you're asking. Because there is tremendous light in the Jewish tradition, especially in the Hasidic, modern version of Hasidism. But nobody has to read that or do it, particularly. So, yeah.
Well, I feel like my question is kind of related to his, in that when you were talking about what a couple can offer each other, that, so you were talking about reparative experiences that you perceive in your partner. That you might be able to offer them even if they resist it. But it seems like self-awareness has to come first before, first of all, for you to be aware enough of yourself to track your own experience, and then aware enough of the other to be able to know what the reparative experience is. And then skilled enough and aware enough to be able to offer it in such a way that it can be received.
Right. I think what happens in Judaism is there is so often innately this desire to fix the world, to what do we come up with?
To heal.
And I actually designed a little exercise to identify your amygdala issues and those of your partners. But these are very good and very difficult, very intelligent questions that I don't exactly feel prepared to answer how that sits in Judaism. I have to think about it. You know,
I can see that it sounds like a good idea, but in practice,
how do you do it?
Yeah.
I think what I think of is that most of the psychotherapists are Jewish, and most of the Buddhists are Jewish, right?
Psychotherapy and
Buddhism. Well,
I would just like to make a comment about Buddhist technology. I have a background in studying creation. I haven't observed in the history of Buddhism that meticulous attention or practice of these technologies that has actually engendered a transformation of behavior.
Watch yourself be small.
Yeah. I'll just pick one famous example, I think my opinion is that Westerners have a very romanticized idea of Buddhist culture. And just to pick one historical example, during World War II, Zen Buddhists, but not only Zen Buddhists, Buddhists in general, were extremely enthusiastic about the Japanese imperial project. And if you read what they wrote at the time, it's actually quite shocking. To conquer another nation as part of the Bodhisattva way, for example. And these were people who had meditated. They'd gone on 100-day retreats and deep in the mountains and all like this, that kind of stuff. So what I'm suggesting is that there's a mysterious element which is really ungraspable that has to be present in order for any of the, for whether you're studying the Talmud, whether you're doing staring at a wall and on your cushion or something like that. Then none of that will be sufficient. None of that will actually engender the kind of transformation that we're talking about. And there is something that's really mysterious about why that happened. I'm not saying you shouldn't do any of those things either. I'm just saying that my observation is that none of them will be sufficient.
Thank you. And actually, what this makes me think of is the the idea that God is going to send you challenges that might help you grow. Like, if you think that learning is all that matters, you might have a child who's unable to think. And that's part of mystery, you know, that things like this come to us. And it's because the universe wants us to grow. There's another way. I didn't talk to you about reincarnation. It's a beautiful way that Jewish mysticism holds reincarnation. And I mentioned how there are these different souls, you know. And so the Kabbalah says that when you die, your body soul hangs out with the body, and you might visit people you love and for a while and so on. I'll skip the emotional soul for a minute. The creative level soul that always knew it was part of divinity goes, oh, thank you, home at last, you know, in this light and beauty that's divinity. And the soul that was always joined with divinity also says, oh, thank goodness. The emotional soul is greeted lovingly by energies of people you've loved or angels, whatever you want to say. And then it starts reviewing your life, and you see, oh my goodness, look what I did to that person at that time. And in this context of beauty and holiness, you want to fix it, you want to learn. So you decide, I better be bored. Like, let's say you scorned someone because they were black or something. You want to be born as black so that you can get that information deeply about what that really is. So I forget what point I'm making. What did you call it? But it's a very beautiful system. And in this system, somebody might spill tea on you, and it might be a fixing for something that happened in another lifetime.
So, I noticed when you said that, as something, it aroused something. It feels like it aroused something in my heart. I can sense the truth in that, well, even though I can't even say why or what. It's a kind of a feeling, but it's not exactly an emotional feeling. But there's some like recognition or something that happened when we spoke.
About what?
Clarify
what it is.
About when he said that none of that would be sufficient. Not Buddhist meditation, not study of the Kabbalah, none of it is it. Kind of like
it
whatever
being,
it.
It being what?
Well, there's that's the mystery.
Like, let's say a wellspring of a sense of divinity.
Your own truth or...
No, I think the question was coming up in the context of how do you know what to do?
What to do?
How do you know how to appear in the world? How do you know? Where do you put what's... And what I understood you saying, Jim, is that these technologies aren't going to necessarily... I mean, you could end up being a Zen Buddhist who's, you know, at the battle lines, you know, killing people and, you know, the whole conviction. And so there's some basic hypocrisy.
Well, I'm not saying that they were hypocrites in Stanley. I'm saying that they were missing something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I mean, I think that they were completely sincere. Even though when I read the writings, I'm going, how could anyone? How could this come out of the mouth of, you know, like someone who had taken Bodhisattva vows? But I honestly believe that they were completely sincere, because the crucial element, which to me really is a mystery, you know, like, is missing.
Right.
You know, like, that gives them a...
living in the unknown.
I mean, you know, the light wasn't turned up.
In that area,
some way.
And I think that's why I started speaking about this idea of reincarnation, because it takes a lot to discover all the areas that we aren't in the light. It's very complex. And you can't just... Yes.
I just wanted to comment, because I thought about these things too, and I'm Jewish, so, and I spent my time at Spirit Rock.
So you did your time.
You put in your time.
But,
you did time.
You know, and I found that it's true, and it was helpful. You know, it was great because the teaching meditation to me is like the door. Nobody in none of my Jewish tradition was a door ever shown to me how I could make contact with myself, how I could find the inner light, how I could hear the inner voice, how I could commune with the divine. So the meditation was really important to me. But at the same time, Buddhism has this message of detachment and that suffering is somehow here to stay and there's something that's sort of a little bit okay about it. I mean, I think it's it shortens their search for the good place that we can all, the good responsible place that I think is what you're talking about when you talk about the inner light. So there's sort of, for me, this mixed bag of Buddhism, you know, the appreciation for the ability to sit still and listen, to sit still, just to sit still, and then to open to within. But, you know, that other stuff about detachment, that's not going to get us anywhere. It, to me, that's like a really negative loop. So I think that's where I find a trap.
So that I agree with you, and that's, I mean, I think there is Buddhist meditation that has what I think Judaism has, which is a joyful enjoyment of this earth. And I think one thing I get out of meditation is trying to appreciate each person for their beauty, their unique beauty. But Judaism definitely appreciates and loves here. And I think some forms of Buddhism do too, actually.
Well, you know, if you don't have if you don't have passion for life at some level, or strive towards finding passion towards life, and what I'm going to call robust love, robust joy, then you're never quite going to get there.
Yeah.
Because that's the place that we want to be, is that joyful.
Yeah.
That joyful
the essential. Place. I think we should probably bring this to a close just because some of you are starting to look tired and, you know, I don't want
to... We want to save something for the Messiah to answer to.
Yes. Yeah, and if it's all right with you, I'd like to end with a song that some of you might know. It's pretty simple if you don't know. It goes like this. Return again. Return again. Return to the land of your soul. Return again. Return again. Return to the land of your soul. Return to who you are. Return to what you are. Return to where you are, born and